Nepal's new constitutional assembly has abolished the country's monarchy and now declared the country a republic. The vote comes as Nepalese lawmakers began writing a new constitution. This is part of a peace deal between government supporters and communist rebels. War between both sides in Nepal killed some 13,000 people over 10 years. Thousands of Nepalese police are now on patrol in the capital, Kathmandu. Several small bombs have gone off in the city this week. Two people have been hurt. A Chicago Transit Authority train derailed earlier today. Chicago fire officials say 10 people have been taken to the hospital with minor injuries. NPR's David Shaper reports.
The elevated train derailed shortly after 10 o'clock at a junction and curve of the tracks over a street on Chicago's south side. The first two cars of the train jumped off the track at the junction, one turning askew but both remaining upright, and neither fell to the street below. Firefighters used ladder trucks and buckets to evacuate some of the passengers from the train. A Chicago Fire Department spokesman says at least 31 people were assessed for injuries at the scene. Only about 14 were transported to hospitals, most in good condition. This is the third serious Chicago Transit Authority train incident in the last several weeks. An elevated train derailed last month at a station on the city's far north side. No injuries were reported. A week before that, another train stalled in a subway tunnel. 100 riders had to be evacuated. 7 were hurt in that incident. David Shaper, NPR News, Chicago.
The Internal Revenue Service says more people are filing tax returns electronically. More than 86 million returns were filed that way this year. About 60% of all returns filed electronically. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from SitForLess.com, selling all colors of the Herman Miller Aeron chair online, including the new color, True Black. SitForLess.com.
On the road again. Just can't wait to get on the road again.
Help WILL reach our annual fundraising goal before you head off on vacation. Tune in Friday, June 6th. For a summer celebration.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Warden Martin Subaru in Savoy. Dedicated to preserving our planet, the Subaru Assembly Plant in Lafayette, Indiana, achieved zero landfill status with nothing from its manufacturing efforts going into a landfill. It's part of what makes a Subaru a Subaru. Information at wardenmartin.com or 352-8910.
It's 6 minutes past 1 o'clock. Today, the afternoon magazine features an interview from the AM 580 archives. Since it's a recorded interview, we won't be taking phone calls this afternoon.
Taking stock of what I have and what I haven't. What do I find? The things I got will keep me satisfied. Check it out. What do I find? A healthy balance on the credit side. Got no diamond, got no pearl, still I think I'm a lucky girl. I got the sun in the morning and the moon at night. Got no mansion, got no yacht, still I'm happy with what I got. No checkbooks, got no banks, still I'd like to express my thanks. I got the sun in the morning and the moon at night. And with the sun in the morning and the moon in the evening, I'm all right. Got no butler.
I got the sun in the morning from Annie Get Your Gun. The original opened in 1946, starring Ethel Merman. The recording we heard was from the 1966 revival. The music composed by Irving Berlin. Irving Berlin said, when you write lyrics for Ethel, they better be good, for if they're bad, everybody's going to hear them Anyhow, this is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn, and on the program today, we're going to talk about Ethel Merman. Carol Flynn is our guest this afternoon. She's a professor of women's studies and media arts at the University of Arizona and the author of Brass Diva, The Life and Legends of Ethel Merman. At the outset of the book, Carol Flynn writes about the power of Ethel Merman's voice, relating Berlin's quip and the comments of others about her famously powerful voice. But right from the beginning, Professor Flynn wants us to know that Merman was more than the voice. She was one very interesting woman, a woman who Flynn says reigned over Broadway not just as its queen, but as its queen during its period of greatest achievement, the golden age of musical theater. Her singing career, notes the author, began in the late 1920s and lasted into the early 1980s. Among the ways Carol Flynn describes Ethel Merman in the first pages of Brass Diva, colorful, with a great sense of humor, hardworking, tough, and vulnerable. Carol Flynn's book, Brass Diva, The Life and Legends of Ethel Merman, is published by the University of California Press. Carol Flynn, good afternoon. Welcome. Thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Hi, thank you.
My pleasure to speak with you. Among the legendary composers Ethel Merman worked with, in addition to Irving Berlin, George Gershwin, Cole Porter, Stephen Sondheim, how did these giants feel about this woman, this singer, Ethel Merman?
Well, with the possible exception of Sondheim, who was quite untried when they worked together on Gypsy, he wanted to write the music and the lyrics, but was relegated only to the lyrics. With the exception of Sondheim, everyone adored working with Ethel because she brought out the best in these giants. Cole Porter actually went so far as to say that there was no other singer he'd prefer writing for than Ethel Merman. And this was from a man who was very careful in his own songs, where he would tend to list popular fans and fads and things, not to bring in stars' names for fear that they would have a rivalry between them. But he was quite unabashed about this. He loved Ethel's voice. He said that she's one of the few Americans who can pronounce her T's and her D's. And, you know, Berwyn's comment that you quoted is really interesting in that Merman had a strong voice, yes. I mean, they called her the 50-megaton voice, and she could project to the back of the theater. But a lot of other stars in the days before mics and amplification could, too. But when Merman belted like that, she didn't lose anything in terms of her clarity or her diction. So it's no wonder that that Berlin and Porter and the Gershwins just loved writing for her. Mm-hmm. She could handle complex rhythms. She could hold a note longer than the Chase Bank, said one critic. She was just amazing.
The voice, the persona we today so readily identify as Merman, was that her from the get-go?
Pretty much. It's real interesting. I can't tell you how many times that people I talked to who knew her said that Ethel Merman never changed. She grew up in a lower middle class family in Astoria, Queens. She was the only child. She took secretarial skills in high school and worked as a stenographer until she made her big break on Broadway. And all through her life, she kept those skills active. She would type up notes after rehearsals. She would type up notes of fancy dinners that she had. She would type up the menus. She would add in corrections and so forth. So she kind of remained that way in terms of her personality. She enjoyed her celebrity, but she never let it go to her head. So in many ways, she did stay true to her roots and never change.
Yeah. And back to the voice, one of the ways you describe it or talk about it in Brass Diva is to call it physical accomplishment, and you liken it to the dancing of Gene Kelly.
I do, in the sense that if you take Gene Kelly and Fred Astaire, the giants of 20th century male dancers, Astaire's brilliance was that he made the dancing look effortless, ethereal. Here was this light, he was a light dancer. It seemed just light of touch and effortless, whereas Gene Kelly's brilliance was in showing you that it took work. His dances were much more physical. And that was the analogy I was trying to draw with Merman, because Merman's voice has been called a lot of things, but ethereal it has never been called. Never light. It's earthy, it's strong, it's powerful, very rhythmic, and not at all genteel. Very, very earthy voice.
It was also interesting to read that there's no public record of the term belting being used in connection with her before 1952.
I was really surprised by that, to tell you the truth, because vocal historians, despite the amount of debate on what belting is and how people define it, which I don't, I'll leave it for others to elaborate, but everyone agrees that it was technologically, historically necessary for singers before amps and mics to be able to fill a theater, whether you were singing opera or you were singing to show tunes or doing stage work. But the term belt didn't enter the vernacular until after the war. I went through every review of her performances I could get my hands on since she started in the mid to late 20s, and that word never hit the press until 52. I was astonished, because that's the word we think of today. That's the only word. We would never call her a blues singer, as people did in the 30s, or a balladeer. One critic even called her a lusty crooner when she was starring in a movie with Bing Crosby, a film version of Anything Goes. And those words just don't come to mind today. But the belt is relatively recent as a term.
Very interesting. Well, we mentioned, I mentioned at the outset, today is the 100th anniversary of her birth, January 16th, 1908. But she insisted she was born later than that.
She, like so many others, Ethel wasn't unique in every way. She would like to shave the few years off of it, and generally, by the time her career was established in the early 30s, after she debuted on Broadway and even made a few films, it seemed that Merman and the press kind of settled on 1911 or 1912. And one of the interesting things, and even her obituary in 1984 reported different years of how old she was. It was really funny how hidden the real date was. But I found the birth records in New York City, and it is 1908, and she couldn't shave too many years off, because one of the powerful stories that she told and retold throughout her career is that she started singing as a child, and in World War II went out to a military base on Long Island and sang to the troops there. So if she's born much later than 1911 or 1912, that's going to become less and less likely possible. So she couldn't shave too many years off, but she by the end of her life, she would mostly just not tell people and laugh it off and make some kind of smart remark about her actual age.
Was vanity part of the reason for shaving 3-4 years off?
It's hard. I don't think I would call her a vain person. I would call her remarkably savvy about her being a media figure. And what strikes me about that is that when you think of stars today, that seems, oh, of course. Right, that seems very ordinary. But for someone who's getting a break in the late 20s and early 30s, and the star machinery, even in Hollywood, was really just starting to heat up. That kind of awareness of Ethel Merman as a public production, as a product of the media, was I think pretty unusual and showed a lot. She was very savvy in terms of that aspect of her and the business part of her career, and I was really struck by that. I mean, her birth name was Ethel Agnes Zimmerman.
Mm-hmm.
And she would always tell people that if you saw that name up in lights, you'd die of a heat stroke. So she wanted to shorten it. And she and her dad had a lot of battles about this. She was quite close to her parents all her life. And the compromise was she would keep the last name but shorten it. So that's how Ethel Agnes Zimmerman became Ethel Merman. And she, even that move seemed to suggest a certain media savvy, too.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about her parents, Agnes and Edward Zimmerman. And Zimmerman not only comes with two M's in this case, but two N's at the end as well.
Yes, and that and Ethel would insist on that being a very important point, because Ethel say, well, the two N's in my last name prove that I'm not Jewish. And all her life and in her afterlife, people are people just assume that she's Jewish. And I can't tell you how many people I've talked to are just completely stunned that she wasn't. And she rarely corrected, in her life, she rarely corrected false media reports about her. But one of the ones that she would always correct was when people said that she was Jewish. Now, part of this, I think, can be linked to an anti-Semitism, conscious or unconscious. And I think part of it, as a close family friend said, she was simply proud to be of her religion. She was Episcopalian, and at some points in her career would practice more than others. But her mom was of Scottish descent, and her dad was of German descent. They'd been, their files are lost in New York, but they were not first-wave immigrants. Ethel's father, Edward Zimmerman, his family had been in the country long enough that one of her relatives, according to her son, had fought in the American Civil War. But they did lead a life of a kind of immigrant culture life in Queens. Her father, for instance, still subscribed to a German language newspaper in New York for the immigrants. And there's I came across a few clippings of his daughter making an appearance at this or that club in German. It was really quite interesting.
Hmm. What were her parents' aspirations for her?
Well, Mom wanted her to be a teacher, because she thought that that would be a good, reputable job. They both wanted Ethel to be able to stand on her own two feet, which is pretty remarkable for parents in the 19-teens to be telling their daughter to rely on herself and not to go out and get married. So that was pretty... her parents were not progressive or radical in any sense, but I find that really interesting. She said she always learned how to stand on her own two feet. Ethel had no interest in being a teacher. She said her mother wanted her to be one because her cousin was one, and her mom liked her cousin. But they had to strike a compromise, and Ethel agreed to take some practical skills in high school and took the stenographer's course, and then within a couple of weeks of graduating, landed a full-time job as a stenographer in a business nearby.
Yeah. Now, they did encourage her in music.
Absolutely. Her dad would play, like a lot of middle-class families, they had a piano in the room, the dining room. You'd think this is the day before radio, even when she's growing up. And they would play. He would play, and Ethel would sing on evenings or days off, and Ethel would tell her first biographer in the 1950s, Yeah, people in the neighborhood always knew when I was singing. The windows were open, and people say that that strong feature, the power of her voice, was always there.
When did the desire come to her to get into show business?
Well, I don't think she ever expected to be a Broadway star. She wanted to be a singer, and I think the Broadway stage star is something that came her way and she embraced because she was so good at it. But as a little girl, like a lot of little girls, especially in New York, which at the time is the absolute center of all kinds of music, popular music, stage music, classical art music, Ethel just was fascinated by all the female singers and would go around the corner of her house, and around then there was the Paramount Studios before they moved to the West Coast. They had their New York filming facilities right around the corner from Ethel's house. And so she and her pals would sneak around the corner and find a hole in the fence and look at all the female stars coming in their fancy cars. And Ethel just loved that. Ethel's father would also take, or sometimes her mom would take Ethel into the city on Friday nights to hear some of her favorite singers. And Ethel just loved that. She would learn their songs and then sing them. So she loved singing, and her parents encouraged her. They were proud of little Ethel Zimmerman.
When and how did she get her first big break?
Well, the break, she is kind of mythic. It's so larger than life, it seems hard to believe. But it is one of those mythic dimensions of Merman that is actually true. She was literally an overnight sensation. Since she graduated high school in 1924, she was working as a stenographer at a brake company, of all places. And at night, then, she would go to different boroughs in the New York area and sing. Well, she was discovered by a number of agents, stars like Jimmy Durante, and eventually George Gershwin went to hear this young girl singer in New York. And he proposed that she star in his and Ira Gershwin's upcoming show called Girl Crazy. And so they brought Ethel into the city, and she said it was like meeting God. She went to their apartment, their penthouse, on the Upper West Side on Riverside Drive. She said she'd never seen a building that tall before, much less been in one. And George Gershwin played some of the songs he expected her to perform. And he said, if you want any changes, just let me know. And here's this barely 20-year-old girl saying, oh, they'll do just fine, Mr. Gershwin. So she's not the star, actually, of Girl Crazy. It was Ginger Rogers was the female lead. Ethel had a really small part. But when she came on, it was the night of October 14th, 1930, the last number in the first act, which is always in a Broadway show, it's always a big number. But folks had no idea how big it was going to be. She gets out there, she's wearing just a simple blouse and a skirt, and blasts out, I've Got Rhythm. And she holds the eye in the chorus for, and reports vary, anywhere between 16 and 32 measures. It was amazing. Mm-hmm. I mean, one critic later wrote that it was a feat equivalent to swimming an Olympic-sized pool underwater twice without ever coming up for air. And the audience just went wild. The producer, who was hiding behind stage with nerves, he thought a gunshot had gone off. There was so much bedlam in the house. And the story that Ethel told from this was that between the acts, George Gershwin, who was conducting that night, came up to Ethel's dressing room and said, Ethel, promise me one thing. What's that, Mr. Gershwin? You will never take a singing lesson in your life. And she never did.
I have a recording of the tune, I Got Rhythm. Now, it's much later than 1930, But maybe we can take a couple of minutes here and listen to it and enjoy it, and then maybe you can maybe tell us another story about Girl Crazy and I Got Rhythm. Here we go. That's the tune that made Ethel Merman a star. I Got Rhythm from the show Girl Crazy. Wow. What did Ginger Rogers make of her on that night, you suppose, back
in 1930? Well, there's varying reports, and as you can imagine, they're one extreme or the other. One set of reports said Ginger was delighted and they got along great, and the other reports involved, you know, seething resentment. So it's hard to say. I mean, but with hindsight, of course, Ginger Rogers never had a great singing voice, and if you're going to be in a Gershwin show, you should have a good singing voice. So I don't think it was that horrible a deal. The poor women did go on to have a decent career.
Oh yeah.
Although actually, it was with Girl Crazy where it was during rehearsals for Girl Crazy where Ginger Rogers was first introduced to Fred Astaire. Ginger Rogers was only 19. Fred Astaire was established and had been a dancer on Broadway with his sister. And they were having, the producers were having wanted a little bit of help choreographing a number in the show. And so Fred Astaire came and helped them out with this number with Ginger Rogers, production of Girl Crazy.
Now, Ethel Merman was all of 22?
Right.
Boy, what
and
a night for her.
She kept her day job. She had a lunch date with the Gershwins the next day and went back to their apartment. I mean, she took the subway back to Queens, and they had she said they had newspapers all over the tables, all over the apartment, and they said, Ethel, have you seen the reviews? And she said, no. And they read them to her, and she had no idea. She just went home, figured she'd done a good job, and that was that. She kind of kept that pragmatic attitude all her life. She never made big bones about it. She didn't care what the critics said. She liked success, for sure, but she was very self-secure. And never, even at that young age, she didn't even have stage fright. She was notoriously confident.
Wow. Ethel Merman is who we're talking about this afternoon in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon is Carol Flynn. She's a professor of Women's Studies in Media Arts at the University of Arizona. Her latest book is Brass Diva, The Life and Legends of Ethel Merman. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments. Join us with a phone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL, and our toll-free number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Looking back on her career, did she have favorites, favorite tunes, favorite shows, favorite people to work with?
Well, she was a little bit more, in some ways she was a little more discreet than Cole Porter. But towards the end of her life, she loosened up a little bit, and she, you know, most stars are not going to give a favorite, like, performer. But Ethel did. She loved working with a very young Jack Klugman in Gypsy, and they became quite close. He became a close friend of her family after working in Gypsy. He, of course, played Gypsy's long-suffering beau, and the two hit it off. She helped him with his insecurities about being in a musical. I mean, Jack Klugman's voice, he's no singer, but she encouraged him, and she just gave him a lot of support and baked chocolate cakes for him every Saturday because she knew he liked chocolate cake. And she also enjoyed working with the Muppets, believe it or not. At the very end of her career, when she was retired from the stage, she did a number of TV appearances, and some of them are, it just seems kind of rote. You got to love her for being able to sing Alexander's Ragtime Band, or There's No Business Like Show Business, or I Got Rhythm, over and over and over. But you could see it in her face. She loved hanging out with Kermit and Miss Piggy, even though Miss Piggy was really full of attitude towards Ethel, very competitive. But she had a lot of fun with them. And she knew she was, in terms of favorite songs, she knew that she had really good material, and she knew that she made good of it. So I don't know if she had a favorite. There are some very touching recordings that she did, even privately, of some of her songs. But I think she respected them all. I mean, she was working. Only in private parties would she mess with the lyrics because she knew she had good stuff.
How did she decide what was right for her?
Everyone says the same thing who knew her professionally or personally, instinct. She knew what songs would work. She knew with her and also with the public. And she would sometimes walk away from songs if she didn't feel that they would do her voice well or go over with the public. And she would sometimes, and Cole Porter says that when they first started working together, Anything Goes in 1934 was their first show. And here's young Ethel, you know, in her 20s, meeting with Cole Porter and with her parents there, telling him of some changes she wanted in the song. And Porter accommodated her, but he was really not the kind of composer who would do this very often. But it was interesting. She really had a great sense of instinct about what material worked and how to pull it over.
Well, tell us about the show, Take a Chance.
Take a Chance was a show that she did in 1932. It actually was a resurrected show of a flop called Humpty Dumpty that died in previews. And Buddy DeSilva, who was the producer and writer and song, one of the songwriters of the show, they kind of scrambled to get the storyline back together, and it premiered in Broadway in 1932 with one of her co-stars was Jack Haley, who would go on to be the Tin Woodsman. He was a big Broadway star in the 30s. And the song that came out in Take a Chance, Ethel played kind of the first of many kind of earthy saloon keeper brassy broads. The brass diva played many a brassy broad, and she played Wanda Brill, the nightclub singer in this show, who was very world-wise, very knowing, and would talk about men and sex with this kind of knowing wink to the audience. And the hit song from Take a Chance was called Edie Was a Lady, and it was this really bluesy torch song. It wasn't this upbeat, high-tempo, I got rhythm kind of syncopated song that Ethel was really good at pulling over. She did a great job with this bluesy number that basically paid tribute to a madame named Edie from turn-of-the-century New Orleans bordello. Mm. And the lyrics are very, very funny and rather bawdy. Edie was a lady, though her past was shady. She had savoir faire. Edie had class with a capital K. And it was just great. However, the song was censored for radio play. And I couldn't believe it because that was the hit. I mean, she would get fan letters saying, Dear Edie, instead of Dear Ethel. It was such a runaway hit, and it was the song that everyone talked about. But it was banned on the radio, which I think just only increased its chances for success. I mean, the crowds just went wild when she sang it.
Yeah. So how did her fans feel about her kind of crossing over from the girl next door to this character?
Well, it was a kind of uneven balance. That's a good question, because she had that uneven balance through a lot of the 30s. Critics would kind of say that Ethel, unlike someone like Mae West, who was also bawdy and could turn sex into a joke, critics repeatedly said, and this is as much about Ethel as an actress, as a comedienne, as a singer, is that Ethel could make the vulgar just kind of like wholesome, good-hearted fun. Mae West couldn't, but Ethel just could turn really blue lyrics into something G-rated and just kind of wink it off and not take it too seriously.
Yeah.
And I found that really interesting about her, because she did have both of those aspects of her persona going on in the 30s.
Yeah, there's a wonderful picture. There's many wonderful pictures in your book, but there's a wonderful picture of her that you have captioned, A Modest Flapper. I love that.
Oh, it's such a sweet one. She's wearing ankle socks and saddle shoes and a dress that flaps open in the front to expose these pretty ugly shorts. and her legs are nice, and, you know, she's a cute girl. But, there's nothing racy about it.
Yeah. Let's take a call. Listener calling in from Terre Haute, Indiana. Line 4, good afternoon.
Yes, Ethel Merman for me is immortalized as Mama, and it's a mad, 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 mad world. I wonder how she got involved with that picture and how she enjoyed that, that it was as much fun to make as it is to watch. So I'll listen for your answer off the air.
Okay. Thanks.
Thank you. That movie, she loved making that movie. And, I mean, it was a big deal for her because it was the first non-singing role that she took, and she had to hold her own up against Jonathan Winters, Terry Thomas, Jimmy Durante, Milton Berle. I mean, every star, every comic was in that movie. Even Buster Keaton had a cameo, and it is just hysterical. She plays Milton Berle's mother-in-law, or mother, And she wears the same obnoxious dress the whole time, big floral print. And it would be typical mother-in-law jokes. And she would just go after Milton Berle, who in actuality was a little older than Ethel, not by much. But they just pulled pranks on each other constantly. I mean, Jonathan Winters would have everybody in stitches in the trailer. And Ethel's son said that she just loved working with him especially. But one day she decided to kind of take on Milton Berle, who was very funny but had an ego that was pretty big. He bugged some of his co-stars because he would always linger in a shot to sort of be the last one to leave the frame, so that audiences would see more of him than anyone else. Ethel decides to be playful one day, and she fills up her purse that was frequently used as a weapon in the movie. She filled it up with all her heaviest jewelry. And in the film, in the script, when it calls for her to kind of beat him on the head with it, beat her sonny on the head with it, she gave him a real clunker. And he had a bump on his head, and for years afterwards, whenever they'd run into each other at nightclubs or whatever, he'd say, "Hey, Mom," and she'd say, "Hey, Sonny, how's the bump?" So they had a lot of fun.
Yeah. Well, one of the ways we can describe Ethel Merman then is playful. We've described her as strong and hardworking, but also another word that comes into the description, all the things that all the words we can use to describe Ethel Merman, is vulnerable. And maybe we should, before too much time goes past here, talk about that side of Ethel Merman. That's something that probably most of us wouldn't think of as a descriptor. That's not a descriptor we would pull out early on in telling folks who was Ethel Merman.
Yeah, you're absolutely right on that. It's very hard to think of this woman who is compared to the atom bomb be considered vulnerable. But people that were very close to the family, in fact, a kind of surrogate son of hers in New York, said that in terms of her private life and her, specifically, her relations with men, that Ethel didn't have those strong instincts of self-preservation. She couldn't spot a phony. Her son told me that Ethel was really good at spotting celebrity phonies or financial phonies. But when it came to men, she didn't always exercise the best judgment. And she was married four times, perhaps most notoriously to Ernest Borgnine. That was her fourth and final marriage in the mid-60s, and that lasted just days in actuality. And after that, when she would date, she would tell people, "I'm not a nun, you know," but some people would just be with Ethel Merman to be with Ethel Merman and not for her. And so, in a way, for as striking as it is about Merman to think of her having this soft side, it's something you hear a lot about these really strong women who are celebrities. Often will have these sides of people who know them really well. That armor, that brass exterior is, for Ethel too, it was to some degree just an act, And she also, another adjective that some folks called her, was shy sometimes. She was quite a performer. She was quite an exhibitionist in that regard. But in some circumstances, she just had to be coaxed into going backstage to talk to people in a show. And those things are really hard to square with the more public production that we think of with Merman, like you were saying.
One of the stories that I have to ask you to tell now is how she handled Ernest Borgnine in her autobiography.
That's a really good one that shows just, her sense of humor was just hilarious. She wrote two autobiographies, one in the mid-50s and then one in the late 70s. And in the 70s, she had to account for that famous union. And so of the 20-odd-whatever chapters of this autobiography, The only one that has a title is one that's called My Marriage to Ernest Borgnine. And it consists of a blank page. And she starts the next chapter saying, my friends know better than to ask. You know, it's what it was a mistake. What can I tell you? That's why God invented erasers. I mean, she had all these comebacks for it. But one thing that is I really respect about her is that she never told anyone, including her family or in her most intimate friends, she never told anyone what was behind the failure of their marriage. Although plenty of people insist on certain explanations, and or that Ethel confided in them late in life about what happened, and she kept mum.
Yeah, classy.
Well, yes, classy but funny. I mean, I like the public reposts about it too. Just you know, that's why God made erasers. I mean, that's a really good line. Yeah. And that wasn't written for her.
Hmm. We've got to wrap up here, and I thought to wind up today, we would play Edie Was a Lady, and a portion of it. And this obviously is recorded much later than 1932. But any final thought on Ethel Merman or on this tune that we'll close out with this afternoon?
Well, I'm glad. I love this song, and I'm just happy to be able to talk about her today because it is her 100th birthday, and this is a small way to celebrate her. So thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Happy birthday, Ethel Merman.
You've been listening to an interview from the Afternoon Magazine Archives, which, of course, you can find on our website at will.illinois.edu. You can sign up for a podcast of the program there and listen to it anytime you'd like. And today, Celeste Quinn was interviewing Carol Flynn, professor of women's studies and media arts at University of Arizona. This is an interview that was initially broadcast back in January of this year about Flynn's book, Brass Diva, The Life and Legends of Ethel Merman. I'm Jay Pierce. It's 152, the highs, lows, and settlements on commodity prices should be in now, and let's get a check on them from Dave Dickey.
Thank you very much, Jay, and good afternoon, everyone. It was definitely a tale of two markets yesterday. Today, the markets in the soybean pit going significantly higher, double-digit increases all throughout the soybean pits, all the way out to July of 2010, while corn was softer yesterday, a softer tone there. So we'll have to talk to Paul Cooley of ADM Investor Services in Oakland, Illinois, during the closing market report at 2:06, have him sort out the whys and wherefores of the market moving in opposite directions in those two grains. Let's go ahead and look at particulars. In Kansas City, July wheat, a high on the day of 810, a low of 791, settling 803.5, down 1.5. December, a high of 838.5, a low of 822.25, settling at 834, down 2. July wheat at the Chicago Board of Trade, a high price on the day of 766.5, a low of 743, settling 759 unchanged. September, a high of 781, a low of 759, settling 774.5, up a quarter. December, a high of 803.25, a low of 780.75, settling 796.25, up a quarter. March, a high of 821.5, a low of $8, settling 815 unchanged. May, a high of 834.5, a low of 813.5, settling 827, up 3. July of 2009, a high of 839.5, a low of 821, settling 835, down 1. Take it out to December of 2009, a high of 871, a low of 850, settling 865, up 1 on the day. July corn, a high of 596.75, a low of 585, settling 592.5, down 5.5. September, a high of 609.25, a low of 598, settling 605.5, down 5.5. December, a high of 623.75, a low of 612.25, settling 619.5, down 6. March, a high of 637, a low of 626, settling 633, down 6. May, a high of 645, a low of 634.75, settling 641.5, down 5.75. July corn, a high of 651.75, a low of 641.25, settling 648, down 6.5. December of 2009, a high of 611.25, a low of 603, settling 608.5, down 6.5. Take it out to May of 2010, a high of 614.5, a low of 614.5, settling 619, down 5.5. July oats, a high of 392, a low of 380.5, settling at 390, down 4. September, a high of $4.25, a low of 394, settling 401, down 4. And then that rally in the soybean pit, the July contract at 1385, a low of 1336.5, settling 1372.75, up 25. August, a high of 1388, a low of 1344, settling 1375.75, up 24.25. September, a high of 1375.5, a low of 1335, settling 62.25. That's 1362.25, up 17.5. Your harvest month in November, a high of 1372. A low of 1330, settling 1357.25, up 16. January of 2009, a high of 1384.5, a low of 1350, settling 1371, up 16. March, a high of 1395, a low of 1358, settling 1382, up 16. May, a high of 1399, a low of 1374, settling 1387.5, up 16.25. July, a high of 1408, a low of 1385, settling 1396.75, up 16.25. November of 2009, a high of 1368.5, a low of 1328.5, settling 1358.25, up 19. July soybean meal, a high of 345.90, a low of 332.30, settling 343.70, up 8.70. August, a high of 348.10, a low of 335, settling 345.80, up 8.10. July soybean oil, a high of 63.17, a low of 61.47, settling 62.65, up 45. The August contract also up 45 on the day. The high there, 63.41, the low, 62.07, and the settlement at 62.98. We'll have settlements from CME Livestock in just a moment. This is Dave Dickey.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Bob Baisdefer in Danville at 217-477-6016. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
And here are those livestock numbers. Live cattle for June had a high today of 96.92.5, a low of 96.20. Settlement 96.72.5, up 2.5. For August, 101.90 was the high. The low was 101.15. The settlement 101.62.5, up 12.5. October live cattle had a high of 108.20, a low of 107.35. The settlement 108.07.5. Up 37.5, and December had a high of 108.75, a low of 108.05. The settlement was 108.52.5, up 7.5. August feeder cattle had a high of 116.25, a low of 115.25. The settlement was 115.80, up 55. September 116.95 was the high, 116.05 the low. The settlement 116.60, up 80. October feeder cattle had a high of 117.65, a low of 116.65. The settlement was 117.32.5, up 47.5. And November feeder cattle had a high of 117.65, a low of 116.90. The settlement was 117.45, up 20. June lean hogs had a high of 77.22.5, a low of 76.45. The settlement 76.75, down 20. July, the high was 76.45, the low was 75.60, the settlement 76.05, and that was up 7.5. August lean hogs had a high of 77.50, a low of 76.90, the settlement 77.40,